Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Wednesday, May 6th, and this week we're diving headfirst into the private markets edition. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex, and Maya, I think headfirst is a perfect description. Because if you thought private markets were opaque before, buckle up.
Right up. We're tackling the biggest shifts impacting the space. First up, liquidity. It's evolved dramatically. But is it enough? We'll dissect the new solutions emerging and what it means for valuations.
And speaking of evolution, the AI infrastructure arms race is reshaping everything. Think of it as a complex tapestry, each new chip, each data set, a fresh thread being woven into the very fabric of fund performance, and the speed is breathtaking.
Breathtaking and potentially destabilizing. Which brings us to geopolitical shocks. Commodity volatility is up 30% since the start of the year, and we're asking, what's the real impact on private equity portfolios?
Then we'll shift to operations. Forget incremental gains, we're talking about a whole new management paradigm. Maya, did you see the latest data on LP expectations for operational transparency? It's wild.
Wild doesn't even begin to cover it. And finally, we'll wrap with credits. New frontiers are opening in private debt, and a surprising number of funds are already exploring non-traditional structures. Alex, prepare to be challenged.
Bring it on. Let's get started.
Nigel Dawn at Evercore said the secondary market has ballooned from $6 billion to $225 billion in transaction volume over the last 20 years. That's a lot of movement for what used to be a niche workaround. Let's talk about the evolution of private market liquidity and why it feels like everything is changing.
Consider this, it's not just the size, it's how that growth is happening. We've seen this fundamental shift, as Dawn pointed out, from a liquidity-driven tool used by LPs out of necessity to a strategic portfolio management instrument. Now investors aren't just selling to get out of deals, they're actively reallocating capital, refining their exposure to vintages and sectors.
Refining their exposure while apparently a lot of new money is coming in. Hamilton Lane's Hartley Rogers mentioned the massive expansion of private markets NAV, up to $10, $15 trillion happening despite stagnant fundraising levels. Where is all this capital coming from if it's not traditional inflows?
That's the crucial point, it's secondaries and co-investments driving growth. Rogers highlights the importance of the secondary market precisely because it's filling that gap. The other major factor is the rise of evergreen structures, which are specifically designed to bypass the traditional fundraising cycle.
Evergreen funds. Everyone's favorite buzzword. Rogers said they're the primary vehicle for bringing private markets to wealth management. But he also cautioned they need massive deal flow and high diversification to succeed. That sounds hard.
It is hard, and that's where the secondaries market becomes absolutely critical for the viability of evergreens. Less dry powder in the buyout market means funds are relying on secondary transactions to acquire assets and build those diversified portfolios. It creates a symbiotic relationship. Evergreens need secondaries, and secondaries benefit from the demand.
And a fascinating power dynamic. Rogers also described megacap managers like Blackstone and KKR creating a structural necessity for secondary players to act as complements, targeting those higher return, harder to access segments the larger providers ignore. It's like they're cleaning up the scraps.
That's a particularly astute way to put it. These players aren't competing head-to-head with the giants. They're focusing on specialization, building portfolios specifically targeting what the mega funds overlook. It's akin to a chef skillfully using every part of the animal. The prime cuts go to the established players, but the skilled secondary market firms are extracting value from the more challenging pieces.
I'm sensing a parallel theme, efficiency. Rogers pointed out the evergreen structure eliminating the liquidity and administrative friction of the drawdown model, like capital calls and subscription agreements. Because apparently, expecting individual investors to manage those things was a bridge too far.
There's a signal here, it's about making private markets more accessible. Rogers positions this as a move towards an ETF-like phase, shifting from broad foundational products to a proliferation of specialized structures. Think customized vehicles tailored to different investor tiers and risk appetites.
Customized vehicles requiring diversification. It all keeps circling back to diversification. But there's a huge risk here, isn't there? As Wendy Lee from Ivy Invest noted, GP-led secondaries represent a major opportunity due to a structural mismatch between available capital and available opportunities. Seems like a recipe for overpaying.
It does, and that's where careful diligence becomes paramount. The secondary market has matured. Kelly Rodrigues touched on the shift from a wild west of unregulated trading to a professionalized, institutional-grade market with transparent trading. More standardized structures help, but the underlying risk remains, finding truly attractive assets in a competitive environment.
Okay, let's talk about retail. The sources suggest retail and semi-liquid evergreen funds account for 10 to 15% of secondary market capital, focusing on higher quality recent vintage assets. What does that concentration of demand actually do to the market?
It exacerbates the demand for those prime assets, driving up valuations. Dawn specifically notes this concentrates demand on high-performing, recent vintage buyout funds. But it also has implications for the broader secondary market ecosystem.
Right, because everyone's chasing the same shiny things. And there's the misconception, Rogers warned, of viewing evergreen funds as liquid ATMs or piggy banks. It's designed for long-term participation, not instant gratification. Which frankly feels like a deliberate attempt to manage expectations.
It is, and it's essential to emphasize that. These aren't readily accessible funds. They're structurally designed for gradual capital exit. That's why Sarsfield maintains liquidity gates are essential to prevent fire sales and protect long-term holders.
Liquidity gates. The industry's favorite euphemism for you can't actually get your money back when you want it. I mean the investment horizon bifurcation, as it's charmingly called, between retail seeking immediate exits and institutional investors opportunistically buying is a structural risk. 5% quarterly withdrawal thresholds are concerning.
They are. The semi-liquid label itself, as Lawrence Calcano points out, creates dangerous cognitive dissonance. Wrapping illiquid assets in structures with redemption gates inadvertently fosters a misunderstanding of liquidity. It's about mechanical access, not actual liquidity.
So we've got massive inflows, secondary markets scrambling to meet demand, evergreen funds managing expectations with gates, and retail investors potentially misunderstanding the whole thing. Has this been tested yet?
That's the million-dollar question. According to the sources, we're entering a critical test period with extended exit timelines and sluggish M&A activity. Whether managers can maintain the cadence of capital return necessary to prevent stagnation is what everyone is watching.
The cadence of capital return? It's like a heartbeat, isn't it? If it slows too much, and institutional investors are already evaluating LP base composition as a primary risk metric, the presence of high redemption risk retail investors could undermine a manager's strategy.
So here's the picture. They're viewing liquidity features as a margin of safety tool, monitoring how managers manage stress scenarios without necessarily triggering the gates themselves. It's a fascinating shift in institutional due diligence.
So we've moved from a niche market to a complex ecosystem with a lot of moving parts, all predicated on maintaining the illusion of liquidity. But that illusion is being challenged by real-world constraints. I think we're going to see some interesting stress tests in the next few years, particularly as companies stay private longer, as Rodriguez mentioned, and need new mechanisms for providing liquidity to employees.
I agree. And while the trend is toward capital replenishment, shifting from secondary trading to providing primary balance sheet capital, the fundamental tension remains: conflicting liquidity needs and a structural mismatch between expectations and reality. The path forward isn't entirely clear. The integration of public and private markets through integrated model portfolios seems likely, but the execution will be critical. We're not sure how those conflicts will resolve, or what it will mean for managers, LPs, or the overall stability of the private markets ecosystem.
And that's genuinely unsettling, the potential for instability in a $10-15 trillion market. Which brings us to the next question. If companies are bypassing traditional VC rounds in favor of continuous funding, what does that do to the infrastructure that supports private markets and the implications for AI infrastructure in particular? Gene Munster called it an early second inning, but it feels more like a gold rush. Everyone thought it was about the models, the algorithms, the software, but it's actually about shovels.
The pattern is clear. The AI infrastructure arms race is fundamentally a capital expenditure cycle in very specific upstream markets. We're seeing hyperscalers translating spend into revenue acceleration, Google search up from 11% to 19% growth, Meta advertising jumping to 33%, but the bottleneck isn't code, it's concrete and copper.
Shovels, transformers, substations sounds a lot less glamorous than large language models.
It is, but that's precisely the point. Amazon's free cash flow dropped to $1.2 billion, a $58 billion swing year over year, all due to property and equipment for AI. Yet the market isn't punishing them. Investors are valuing CapEx as a signal of future growth, despite the immediate hit to profitability.
So productive versus unproductive CapEx, as they're calling it. The market cares if the money buys results. Meta's stock reaction to its $125 to $145 billion spending plan illustrates that perfectly.
But the defining characteristic right now is that demand is outpacing supply. It's not just about having the capital, it's about securing the resources to deploy it. That's why we're seeing this unprecedented vertical integration.
Let's unpack that. SpaceX's Terafabs isn't a cloud play. It's Elon insulating Starlink and XAI from semiconductor constraints.
Correct. And NVIDIA's $500 million Corning investment following stakes in Lumentum and Coherent isn't about GPUs directly. It's about the supply chain stack, particularly optical and networking components. They're anticipating the transition to silicon photonics in 2027 to 2028 and preemptively securing capacity.
So instead of just buying the GPUs, they're buying the factories that make the parts that make the GPUs.
It's a strategic pivot to control interconnection as rack density increases. Michael Reiter highlighted this, focusing on investments in cooling and power, the shell as the most reliable value capture point, avoiding the risk of rapidly obsolescing chip technology.
10 kW racks to 100 kW racks. That's a significant jump.
And it fundamentally changes the structural requirements. Air cooling is insufficient. We're talking about a shift to liquid-to-chip systems, which means building foundations have to be re-engineered.
Foundations. Who knew foundations were the new edge?
It's not just the cooling, it's the power. Blackstone is seeing a potential 40% increase in U.S. power demand over the next decade, driven by AI and reindustrialization. And that's where the real bottleneck is emerging.
7-year interconnection queues in certain jurisdictions. That's not great.
It's a crisis. The U.S. hasn't constructed a new interstate pipeline since 2018. A 10-gigawatt load center represents engineering challenges comparable to building Chicago's entire high-voltage infrastructure in 5 years.
So the scaling problem isn't just about the quantity of data centers, it's about getting them plugged in.
Two things stand out. This is why we're seeing a rotation toward energy security and defense, hedging against geopolitical instability and, critically, the massive power requirements of AI.
And it explains why developers prioritizing brownfield strategies, acquiring existing sites with power access over new construction. Incremental power is now the primary bottleneck.
The implication runs deeper. Hyperscalers prioritize speed of delivery over cost. They'll pay a premium for debottlenecking challenges.
Alphabet's comparatively modest CapEx increases, relative to Microsoft and Meta, signaling superior capital efficiency. Is that their play, do more with less?
It appears so. They're maximizing compute utilization across search, YouTube, and cloud, driving margin expansion. It's a relative growth game. Microsoft's cloud growing at 39% is notable, but Google's jump to 63% indicates competitive momentum.
So the race isn't solely about raw spending, it's about squeezing the most value from existing infrastructure.
Worth noting yet, there's an emerging regulatory crisis over cost allocation. Regulators are attempting to protect ratepayers from the infrastructure costs required to support these concentrated high-scale industrial loads.
Everyone wants the AI benefits, no one wants to pay for the power grid.
A classic externality problem. But even if they solve the regulatory hurdles, there's a looming risk of structural oversupply. If chip efficiency improves faster than anticipated, that massive investment in baseload gas generation could be wasted by 2030.
A $600 billion build-out potentially for nothing.
Or at least for significantly reduced returns. And finally, let's not forget the copper. 25 to 30% shortfall projected by 2035, driven by the jump from 5,000 tons in conventional data centers to 50,000 tons in hyperscale facilities. Urban mining is no longer a fringe idea.
We're building the future on old plumbing. This is the part that keeps me up at night. The entire system is predicated on a supply chain that simply isn't built for this level of acceleration.
It's a fundamental mismatch between projected demand and existing infrastructure planning models. And it's a problem we won't see fully materialized until well into the late 2020s and early 2030s. This all ties directly into the next conversation, geopolitical shocks and commodity volatility. Because the infrastructure requirements we're discussing are almost entirely dependent on secure access to raw materials and stable global supply chains.
Because if you can't get the shovels, it doesn't matter how good your digging plan is. You know what I noticed this week? Every gas station seems to be holding a grudge against my wallet. It feels less like filling up a car and more like funding a small nation. Let's talk about the commodity shocks rippling through everything, specifically how the Middle East situation is wreaking havoc.
The data tells a story. The escalation with Iran isn't just a headline. It's fundamentally reshaped the energy supply picture. We saw global crude reserves fall by a staggering 6.5 million barrels per day in April, and Goldman Sachs is warning we're down to 45 days of refined oil products globally. That's an incredibly fragile position heading into peak travel season.
45 days. That's not a lot of wiggle room. It's like deciding to go on a cross-country road trip with half a tank of gas and a vague sense of optimism. So what's happening beyond the immediate price spikes at the pump?
The initial shock was Brent crude hitting $115, naphtha doubling, triggering a plastic production crisis in Asia, particularly in Indonesia, as Disney CEO is now grappling with. But the closures in the Strait of Hormuz, really since late February, are creating a wider secondary impact. Jet fuel costs have doubled, fertilizer prices are up twofold, and we're seeing a domino effect throughout manufacturing.
Domino effect is a polite way to put it. The U.S. automotive sector is bracing for a $5 billion loss this year. And it's not just fuel, right? It's aluminum, plastics, paint, the whole build.
Stepping back, it's a material supply crunch. The disruption is so pervasive that it's exposing vulnerabilities in incredibly complex supply chains. The June tipping point, as it's being called, will be the moment strategic reserves and floating inventories are exhausted. Then we're looking at either severe shortages or a contraction in global oil demand, a deeply undesirable outcome.
So basically, the world has to collectively decide to drive less or face some very real pain. Is increased U.S. shale production going to be a savior here?
Unfortunately, no. The industry simply lacks the capacity for a rapid response. It's not a light switch operation. Deploying the investment, equipment, and crews required for new wells takes significant time, and it's not happening fast enough to offset the Middle East supply shock.
It's like expecting a turtle to win a race against a jet ski. What about the other side of the equation? Is China just sitting back and watching this happen?
China is a key player in the standoff. Daniel Lackall pointed out that this isn't solely a geopolitical crisis. It's a proxy economic war, a demonstration of control over critical resources. China has significant oil stockpiles and land-based import options, giving them considerable staying power, which other nations simply don't have.
So a war of attrition. A really expensive, globally disruptive war of attrition.
In essence, yes. And the US dollar is reacting accordingly, strengthening as a petrocurrency, with a potential spike to 99.38 on the DXY chart if the conflict intensifies. But the really concerning trend is policymakers focusing on windfall profit taxes.
Windfall profit taxes? Isn't that punishing the company's best position to increase security of supply?
Something to flag here, it undermines the very businesses that could improve system flexibility and alleviate the crisis. It exacerbates the problem. We're seeing energy costs act as a continuous drag on GDP growth, and Sam Fleming projects this will erode household disposable income throughout 2026.
Okay, so the pain is baked in for a while. Are we looking at a sustained higher price environment, or is this a temporary spike?
Elevated prices are likely at their peak, but the critical issue is the reemergence of a geopolitical risk premium we haven't seen in recent years. Prices will remain significantly higher than January 2026 levels, regardless of potential dips. Eric Townsend believes the market is fundamentally underestimating the severity of this oil crunch.
Underestimating how? Like panic level underestimating?
It's a telling detail. He predicts a broader market sell-off, even including sectors like uranium stocks, despite bullish fundamentals, because of the overall disconnect between market perception and reality. He also highlighted refinery shut-ins as the next critical risk factor. As oil supplies dwindle, refineries will halt operations, further exacerbating the crunch.
So a cascading series of failures. It feels inevitable, honestly. Brent crude is already at its highest level since 2022, driving inflation. Even the Fed is holding steady, influenced by those rising energy prices.
It's a complex system with a lot of interconnected parts, and the Middle East conflict is acting as a major stress test. We're seeing inflation rates climb, but the bigger concern is the broader economic impact.
It's a strange situation. You have to wonder if this disruption is a harbinger of things to come. It's almost reminiscent of the oil shocks of the 1970s, but with the added complexity of semiconductor dependencies and a completely different global power structure. It feels like the economic equivalent of trying to perform open-heart surgery during an earthquake. And that level of instability inevitably shifts focus to operational resilience, internal controls, and ultimately proactive risk management. Robert Irving is pushing this idea of operator-led private equity, essentially, by companies and let the people who actually do things run them, not just financiers. Sounds quaint.
It's not quaint, it's a recognition of where value is truly created, especially in fragmented service markets. Irving's point, supported by Alpine Investors' model, is that the efficacy of an investment thesis is now measured by its ability to decouple identity from capital. Finance is enabling, but the sustained advantage lies in standardized processes executed effectively, scheduling, dispatching the boots on the ground, as he puts it. And crucially, shared operational language.
Because a spreadsheet can somehow magically instill a culture of excellence. Let's be real, buying a pool cleaning company doesn't suddenly make it Goldman Sachs.
The culture isn't instilled, it's identified and leveraged. The two converging paths framework illustrates this. Talent retention isn't about perks, it's about organizational alignment, ensuring an employee's career growth intersects with the operational needs of the business. It's about finding companies where the right people are already in the right seats. Think of it as buying a functioning engine, not a pile of parts.
So find well-run small businesses and pay more for them. That's the revolution.
It's deeper than that. It's about leadership. Brian Chesky's founder mode is the parallel here. He argues the era of pure people managers is ending. We need leaders actively involved in the technical details, maintaining contact with reality. A hands-on approach, like a golf instructor, building operational muscle memory, prevents stagnation. This directly impacts M&A integration, preventing the game of telephone Irving describes, where crucial insights from technicians are lost.
Okay, wait. You're saying future CEOs need to be like hyper-involved micromanagers? I thought the whole point was delegation.
Not micromanagement, granular involvement. Chesky advocates for AI founder mode, arguing that AI provides near-instant access to every detail, demanding a level of involvement exceeding traditional management. This facilitates a shift from meetings to asynchronous workflows and necessitates a hybrid manager-SE model. It's about managing through the work itself, using output as the primary lever for accountability.
Honestly, it sounds exhausting. Like everyone's constantly auditing everyone else.
That's the paradox. Centralized, decisive leadership, capable of that granular involvement, actually empowers subordinates. As Irving notes, enduring companies remain in founder mode the longest, building a massive intellectual property reservoir. This requires removing abstraction layers, eliminating the game of telephone, as Chesky also frames it, to maintain direct contact with the source of truth.
And if you can't find a founder-like figure, just hire a really good project manager. I swear, if I hear synergy one more time.
It's about prioritizing inputs over outputs. The focus shifts to perfecting the 10,000 details, as Chesky calls them. WCM's culture by inversion model also supports this. Overtrusting employees to trigger reciprocity reduces the need for bureaucratic oversight. They've proven that pre-vetting employees through high-performing staff is a powerful scaling mechanism, effectively using professional nepotism to maintain their ecosystem.
Professional nepotism? Are we just openly admitting that the entire system is based on who you know now? This is getting disturbing. Look, it's May 6th. I'll bet you that by December 6th, we'll see at least 3 mid-market PE firms announce leadership development initiatives that are just rebranded project management training.
I'll take that bet. I predict that by December 6th, we'll see a documented increase, at least 15%, in the percentage of PE portfolio company executive roles explicitly requiring pre-existing operational experience within the specific industry segment the firm is acquiring in, rather than purely financial backgrounds. The market will reward those firms that prove they can decouple identity from capital and build leaders who truly understand the work. It's a shift to rigorous pre-vetting and operational language, not simply a branding exercise.
Fair enough. Which brings us nicely to how all this operational complexity impacts the actual capital flow, the new frontiers in credit and private debt. James Crombie at Citi calls private credit funds well leveraged. Doesn't that feel generous?
It's a relative statement, certainly. Compared to traditional bank lending, private credit does have a superior asset liability mismatch profile. Retail exposure is around 20%, and contractual leverage limits are lower. But that doesn't mean it's without risk, especially as more capital floods in. The key concern, as Citi highlights, isn't the established players, but these tourists lacking workout experience.
Tourists? A lovely euphemism for people who haven't seen a true credit cycle.
Hard landing could force those less experienced lenders to sell loans below economic value, creating a contagion effect the market isn't prepared for. We're seeing discerning risk appetite increasing with price discrepancies across segments. That's an early warning sign.
So the established players are okay, the newbies aren't. What could actually trigger this?
Institutional capital withdrawal. That's what Mickey Basher at Citi flagged as the biggest risk. It could originate anywhere, and retail investor sentiment could be the spark. A substantial pullback could create a refinancing gap, particularly for middle market companies relying on that capital.
Middle market refinancing gap's fantastic. It's like a domino rally where one slightly wobbly domino is an $85 billion Oracle bond payment.
That's a good analogy, actually. Speaking of Oracle, Cordes's point about hyperscalers converging public and private debt is critical. It means traditional industry diversification is becoming obsolete. You're looking at unified factor risk. They're leveraging off-balance sheet financing like guaranteed power deals, effectively creating unlimited high-quality credit supply.
Unlimited credit supply funded by power deals, and we thought close were complicated.
We can trace that further. It forces a game board view. Evaluating a single issuer requires looking at all their commitments, not just public spreads. Attractive public debt can be undermined by expensive private loans in related areas.
That sounds like finding a good deal on a car where you later discover the engine is held together with duct tape and optimism.
An apt comparison. Thankfully, widening public market spreads are now matching movements in the private sector, which is creating a more attractive yield environment. The expansion of private credit is also diversifying, moving beyond leveraged loans into IG plus situations and asset-backed spaces.
So more sophisticated asset classes, interconnected debt profiles, and tourists with questionable exit strategies. If institutional capital dries up by, say, the end of 2024, leaving a middle market refinancing crunch, will we see a coordinated response like Citi's strategy of smoothing liquidity between public and private markets actually hold?
That's the key question. The reciprocal relationship Citi is building, stepping in when one market closes, is a mitigating factor, but its effectiveness will be truly tested if we see broad, systemic withdrawal. We need to watch Oracle's $85 billion refinancing closely over the next 12 to 18 months as a bellwether.
Pulling back from the specifics, AI infrastructure, commodity spikes, the operator-led PE shift, and the expansion of private credit, it feels like we've been documenting a fundamental recalibration in how private markets are valued, accessed, and ultimately function. We talked about secondary market volume ballooning to $225 billion, but I keep coming back to Nigel Dawn's point about this being a relatively new phenomenon. It's a lot of movement for what used to be a niche workaround, and now it's exerting a real gravitational pull.
And that pull is revealing a deeper tension, the desire for mechanical access to illiquid assets colliding with the reality of, well, their illiquidity. It's as if everyone's simultaneously discovering the limitations of the game board, assuming everyone else can find a buyer, but lacking a consensus on true price discovery. The $10-15 trillion NAV is a staggering figure, but liquidity isn't simply a function of size. We're seeing a situation where expectations aren't anchored to fundamentals, and as we saw with Oracle's looming $85 billion bond payment, the cadence of capital return will be paramount.
And it's not just about access, but what that access is being used for. The shovel's analogy for AI infrastructure is potent. Everyone's racing to build, but building what exactly? And at what cost? Commodity volatility up 30% since the start of the year paints a very precarious picture. It's not simply a cost increase. It's a geopolitical risk premium reemerging, and the $6.5 million barrels per day drop in global crude reserves underscores that fragility.
The pattern is clear. The initial capital deployment, the early software phase, masked the capital intensity of the physical layer. Now we're seeing that the infrastructure buildout will require sustained power and resource commitments. It feels almost industrial in a way we haven't seen in private tech for a while. The shift toward operator-led PE, championed by people like Brian Chesky, is almost a response to that. It's a recognition that hands-on involvement, granular operational control, and a focus on internal capabilities are crucial when dealing with these foundational, real-world complexities. It's moving away from purely financial engineering and demanding a foot-on-the-ground approach.
But even that's not a guaranteed solution, right? Because if everyone's playing operator, there's still a risk of overpaying for assets, especially as evergreen funds, those ATMs, continue to swell. And the private credit market, as James Crombie highlighted, is exhibiting imbalances. More capital, less experience, it feels like a domino rally waiting for a nudge.
It does. The stress tests are coming undoubtedly. The next 12 to 18 months, specifically Oracle's refinancing in the broader M&A landscape, will reveal the structural resilience or fragility of these arrangements. And looking ahead, the documented 15% increase in PE executive roles requiring operational experience signals a crucial adaptation. I'm watching for any evidence that Citi's reciprocal liquidity mechanisms will prove adequate in the event of a systemic withdrawal. I'm skeptical, frankly.
I share that skepticism. This has been a fascinating and, frankly, a little unnerving exploration. We're seeing a convergence of forces, unprecedented liquidity, geopolitical instability, and a fundamental shift in how value is created.
It feels like we're tuning a very complex instrument, and some of the strings are dangerously taut.
Thanks for joining us this week. We'll be back next week with a deep dive into, well, we'll see what unravels between now and then.